Blog Talk Radio.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room, or grab your phones, call in, and join the conversation. Help us to restore the republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time, yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up and shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.
Woo-hoo-ee, so much for American. Global warming. In this really chilly Tuesday here in the usual warm south on Blog Talk Radio High Five, and wind up on the page on Kinetic High Five. Welcome everyone listening.
Good afternoon, Annie. Good afternoon, everybody.
And I just need to turn this mic on. I hope everyone's enjoying this second Arctic vortex of this global warming imagination. And we have a great show lined up. We're going to have calling in quarter after the hour, Michael Johns, who is a political analyst, and he was one of the original movers of the Tea Party movement here in the United States. And I got to tell you, I've been having the last couple of days, I've been a little bit hectic. I've been a little nuts. We have in town filming our Tea Party meetings, TV4 Sweden. So I had my general meeting last night, and I felt like a dang fool. They had filmed me coming into the parking lot and walking into the restaurant, and I hate that stuff sometimes. Let's see if my co-host is back with us again. Cool Mike, you with us?
I'm here. As always. As always, things only start happening in my life Tuesdays and Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Nothing before them. But it's great to be here, Annie. Thank you very much. Oh, boy.
Yeah,
well, you got more story. You're rolling already, Annie, so all of the...
Well, between our meeting last night and TV4 from Sweden being there to film us, and then, of course, we had the local newspaper pop in, and then tonight we've got our candidate forum for the candidates that are running against Lindsey Graham, but we also got this weather front coming in. And I tell you, people in South Carolina do not know how to drive on icy snow roads. And they're even threatening snow down here in South Carolina. So it's going to be interesting to see whether or not I get my candidates to actually show up. I don't want them
to
put their lives
at risk. Well,
it's
0 degrees right now. As I speak, it's 0. And there's a I don't think the schools have been open since last week. So you can't have it any worse than us.
Whoa. Well, I'm telling you, these people down here do not know how to ride on icy roads. I don't even think they have a snow tire inside the state of South Carolina. If you can find one, you're going to be very lucky. So I
Of course, you also drove on the East Coast as a police officer. I mean, you're familiar with all kinds of weather.
Right, right.
These people are not.
No, they're not. But I don't want these guys putting their life at risk. You know, it's not worth it. We can always do, you know, something else. But what I came up with is for the people that do show up, because where we are in Buford, we're tucked in a little bit, so 95% of bad weather misses us. So we always end up being the warmest area. So I don't expect the ice that, you know, they would have, say, in Charleston or, you know, further away. So what I did was I took all the videos from the candidates' debate from last weekend up at the Tea Party convention. And then I transcribed it, and I created a straw poll out of it. So I'm going to play that video, breaking it down to each question and response, and have them do a straw poll.
Nice.
And, yeah, so I was working
Who's
on that.
Who's doing the thinking down in Buford County, huh? That's Annie Ubelis. I assume Yanni didn't help you with any of this.
No, Yanni does not know how to text. So I don't think he could do that. So I put this together, and then TV4 Sweden's going to come back in just before the presidential State of the Union, and then they're going to film us and get our responses. So it's going to be a hectic evening. And I'm telling you, anyone rings my phone before 3 o'clock in the afternoon tomorrow, I will be locked and loaded. Anyway,
well,
Michael Johnson.
Well, our big controversy up in Grand Rapids is there's a guy, his name is Mr. Lambert, and he's a real good guy. He has an open carry, and he comes to the city hall meetings in his holster, and the mayor doesn't like it. He said it's intimidating. Of course, he wasn't. That's the only controversy striking us. But tonight's going to be exciting. You know, we'll go to our dedication, and maybe if we have time, we'll talk about the state of bullshit.
Well, that we'll be talking with Michael Johns. Let me go through with the dedication. And those that listen to our show know that we start off each show with a dedication to a fallen hero, whether they're military or first responders. And today's dedication is going out to Army Sergeant First Class William K. Lacey, who was killed Saturday, January 4th, 2014, defending the base in Nangarhar, Afghanistan. And this was written in the ISAF Regional Command North. The story is by Lieutenant J.G. Brian Mitchell. This is from Camp Marmal, Afghanistan. The turtle is coming home, an heirloom, for the guardian angel has fought his last fight, and his solemn comrades found fortitude amid the grief by honoring a soldier who lived with honor and perished protecting those he loved. Sergeant First Class William K. Lacey was remembered by scores who knew him and hundreds who wished to render tribute to a soldier who epitomized the highest ideals of national service. He died a warrior's death, defending his soldiers, said Captain David Darling. Less than 2 weeks before, he was slated to return home to Kentucky. Lacey sprung from his bed shortly before sunrise on January 4th. Insurgents had attacked his outpost. He was the first on the scene, said Chaplain David Howell, vulnerable and exposed, but suppressing fire. A car bomb slashed through a section of the perimeter wall in the Nangarhar province compound. At least 6 enemy fighters, some clad in suicide vests, were storming the base. Lacey assumed a high position on a guard tower and is credited with killing 3 assailants, 2 of whom wore suicide vests, before a rocket-propelled grenade claimed his life. His death marks the first combat death for Americans serving in Afghanistan in 2014. He was the only American killed in the attack. All 6 of the insurgents died. Originally from Laurel, Florida, the 38-year-old soldier was a vehicle mechanic assigned to the 201st Brigade Support Battalion, 3rd Brigade Combat Team, 1st Infantry Division at Fort Knox. He was highly decorated and an experienced soldier serving in the Afghan battlefield. We recite the soldier's creed, and we say we live by a warrior's ethos, but all too often they are just words soldiers recite, said Lieutenant Colonel William Jacobs. Sergeant Lacey, on the other hand, lived and died by the soldier's creed and the warrior ethos. He fell on a pile of his own spent brass. First Sergeant Louis Stenke, who organized the memorial ceremony aboard the sprawling outpost in northern Afghanistan, staved off his intense emotion to describe Lacey's heroism. The lives he saved are countless as he defended the camp and the soldiers he cared about so greatly, Stenke said. Born in a military hospital in the summer of 1975, raised in an Air Force family, and bred to wave away exhausted pesky mosquito, wished himself being 2nd Airborne Division and went on to 3 tours in Iraq and a previous tour in Afghanistan. In his mind, it was always too nearly to quit. You always preserve, you always find a way, Howell said. His decorations include the Purple Heart, the Bronze Star with Valor, and the Army Commendation Medal. Danger was a familiar companion to Lacey, but he was often found smiling and ready to help anyone, Howell said. The chaplain cast his sacrifice in terms uniquely resonant with the camouflage-clad audience. Without question or pause, he was willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause. Jacobs read from a letter Lacey's wife Ashley wrote for the ceremony. In it, she describes a soldier brimming with positivity and recalls their rendezvous with fate. Lacey and his soon-to-be bride were deployed together in Iraq when her vehicle was struck by a roadside bomb. He pulled me from the Humvee, and as soon as we were cleared of any secondary devices, he came to my aid, she wrote. We then developed a bond that no one can compare. He saved my life. Exactly a year later, they were wed. I spend every day of the past 5 years owing my life to him and feeling so lucky to have him, she wrote. She also recalled the last time they spoke. He was so happy on our video chat just a few hours before everything went down, she wrote. His smile and his laugh. Ashley also thanked her husband's comrades for taking such tender care of the stuffed turtles Sergeant First Class Lacey had carried in his cargo pocket throughout his tour. His daughter, Lily, carried a matching turtle. I believe he was my guardian angel, and I know now more, so I believe he is with me and our daughter, she wrote. Held in a German aircraft hangar, where his iconic fallen soldier battle course was flanked by an American and German attack helicopter, the ceremony was attended by hundreds of soldiers from at least a dozen countries. Service members who knew Lacey only his legacy. I'm sorry. Service members who knew Lacey only by his legacy volunteered to convert a dingy hangar into a hall worthy of reverence, while others donated individual items. A German-based American soldier played taps on his bugle, while a German officer left every eye moist with a stirring rendition of Amazing Grace on bagpipes. After the official party had rendered the final salute and strode out, the hangar remained silent for nearly an hour as troops from across the coalition, from Belgium and Mongolia, from Latvia and Germany, from Croatia and from the United States of America, stood respectfully before his rifle, boots, dog tags, and turtle to pay their final respects. Dozens tore their unit patches and placed them before his boots. With only a few mourners remaining in the hangar, a heavy sadness still lingering and the eyes still moist, Stenke carefully packed the battlefield cross items and scores of patches. Lastly, he held the turtle for a moment. paused with his eyes shut before he packed it to be reunited with its twin in Kentucky. Our nation is fortunate that we can still draw on immense reservoirs of courage and fortitude and character of men like Sergeant Lacey, Howell said. We are blessed with heroes such as him. This show is dedicated to all the brave men and women who have served, who are serving, and who will serve. We can never thank them enough, but we dedicate this song to them. My Name is America by Todd Allen Heron.
In the grip of oppression, I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. When I'm attacked, I protect and defend, because my name is America. I stand proud and free. My name is America. Don't tread on me. I cannot be broken. I cannot be shamed. Believe in the virtues I stand for, my respect for humanity. Now I'm challenged by tyrants who envy my power, but their vicious deeds become my finest hour. Because my name is America, I stand proud and free. My name is America. Don't tread on me. I cannot be broken. I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get stronger, and I'll rise up from the
Allen Herndon, My Name is America. You know, Mike, sometimes some of these dedications just get so difficult, and I had a hard time towards the end of that, if you notice. But, you know, we can never say thank you enough to these brave men and women.
No, we cannot, Annie, and that's why we start the show off that way, and no need to apologize for getting emotional. We've said it before. Every single dedication we do is a brother, a sister, period. We got
okay.
Thomas on. We're going to have to turn the echo down there.
No, I think it's our guest, Michael John. So before I light up his mic, if he can turn down the volume on his speakers there, because we're getting a little feedback, and we'll bring him
just
on as soon as he does that.
Just to jump back into that dedication, it just goes to show you how, number one, a person's willing, our great military people and our law enforcement, they're willing to die for others first. And even when, before they close their final eyes for the first time, they're holding something of sentimental from a loved one because they're not even thinking of themselves. I had my mic muted, but let me tell you, it was pretty emotional for me as well. And, you know, God bless America and God bless our fighting forces.
Yeah, and that Lieutenant J.G. that wrote that tribute really did a fantastic job. So let's welcome now, as we go on with our show, Michael Johns. Good afternoon, Michael.
Annie, good to be with you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure with us. I mean, what is with this global warming here, Michael?
Yeah, certainly not manifesting in any significant degree of warming if you're in the Northeast or just about anywhere in the United States, is it? And I think, you know, I mean, so I know liberals kind of make fun of conservatives. You make a point out of that. But the reality is, you know, these are major scientific conclusions under which there is ongoing and considerable debate and plenty of room for skepticism. And I don't speak for all conservatives on this issue, but my view is, you know, let the science be the science. Don't let politics or policy drive what is in essence a scientific conclusion. And that is my greatest concern, is that that's exactly what's transpired. It's happened on many other issues historically where you have a progressive movement. And by the way, conservatives need to be conscious of not doing this as well. They sort of say, okay, here's the end result that we want to end up with politically. What are kind of the facts that we can create or recreate or spin in certain ways that will lead us toward that conclusion? And I think in a lot of respects, I don't think there's much debate, you know, for anyone who followed this whole so-called hockey stick controversy and the omitted data and the blunt statements of the scientific community that were behind a lot of this, that there's clearly been a very politicized agenda to try to sell to the United States and to the world a thesis that is a very, very bold one, and one under which there remains, you know, continued, skepticism and unreliable data.
Now, what I find funny, though, was it just last week the UN came out and was blaming global warming on the human factor, especially the United States, and yet that report completely, absolutely ignored the Third World and China.
Completely. Yeah.
China's building what, a coal plant every single day?
Well, and, you know, I mean, there was also within the last 2 weeks, other analysis that was put out, you know, because, I mean, for those who've been, you know, say in Los Angeles, let's just sort of take that as a city in Los Angeles. I mean, the smog there is undeniable. All right. So, I mean, that's indisputable that it exists. The role of China in that smog manifested within this study. And yet, as you correctly point out, within the UN, within most of these international organizations, again, it's politics and money that are driving decision-making, and the decision is essentially that they want the United States to continue to fund experimental programs or bold or to hamper its own energy resources at a time when really, in my judgment, the biggest challenge facing the United States is job creation, economic growth, and reasonably priced energy. And this administration and their allies in Congress have, in essence, pursued an agenda of raising energy prices. In fact, American people didn't pay enough to what Obama said about that in the 2008 campaign, when he was very clear-cut that would be the end result of the policies he was putting in place. He's clearly done nothing from the standpoint of facilitating expanded access to our own petroleum and natural gas resources. And, you know, and simultaneously, we've had growing prices in electricity that have been hampering to many working families. So, you know, the agenda has, in my judgment, started out being a political one. I don't doubt there's people, a lot of people, that are good-willed on the other side on this issue. But, you know, the lesson really is, you know, have the science evaluated in the open, not behind closed doors. You know, ensure that the scientists that are perpetuating this do not have a hidden political or financial agenda behind their conclusions. And, you know, when it comes to making decisions of this magnitude, you know, make sure we have our facts first. And I don't believe that's been done at all.
No, I don't believe either. And last night we had our monthly Tea Party meeting, and one of the individuals running against Lindsey Graham is our state senator, Lee Bright. And he actually put it in a personal manner, you know, because we as conservatives, we always talk with our head, and we never translate it into something emotional like the Democrats are so good at doing. But he did this so well. He says, you know, I know what it's be on the economic ladder where you're always high, day down the neck. He had, and here now the EPA comes in with all these new rules and regulations, and he spent something like $5 million
on thousands of these. I mean, we all talked, I think, openly about, and I think it's widely known by the American people that the 2,000-page Obamacare bill was not read by one member of Congress. Well, I mean, that's horrific. Go further now into these EPA regulations, which are going to have hugely hampering impact on American job creation and industry. And you realize, in essence, that these things, and then this, I think it's to the broader point, which, you know, we didn't need to talk about, which I think is, in essence, this ongoing erosion of democratic accountability of this government, you know, that in essence, you know, we have an administration that through edict, through regulation, through anything that they can do on their own that doesn't require open hearings or open discussion or transparency or, by God, bipartisanship, I mean, none of that, that's in essence become the political means to the end of this administration. I mean, so, you know, I guess kudos to them for just saying we're going to force ahead regardless of, you know, constitutional constraints or, you know, the impact on how we're perceived by the American people. But every American should have grave concern by the fact that this administration is discarding the rule of law, checks and balances, all of the components really that have comprised the genius of American political liberty.
Yeah, well, I was trying to make the point where he brought it down to a personal level, where he explains how he ended up losing his entire trucking business because of the amount of money that he had to pour into it, and the loans he had to take out, it actually bankrupted him. And he said, here I had myself a $10 million trucking business, and I've lost it all. Not only that, all the people that I employed, they lost their jobs. And when you stop and think about it, when you drive down the road, there used to be, when I first came down to South Carolina back in 1998, you would pass truck after truck after truck after truck, especially in North Carolina, which was known as Virginia and North Carolina as the trucking states. Now when you go up and down I-95, you don't see as many. You see maybe one-fourth the amount of trucks you would have seen in 1998. And this is what the EPA and the government regulations have done. They have destroyed full industries. They have destroyed people's lives.
And people's lives. Exactly, people's lives. And actually, I think that's very well put. I mean, is it, you know, whether it's a coal miner or whether it's a working family who's had to pay more in you know, the electricity bill and what they've had to compromise to get that done. You know, these are real human stories. Impacts on the lives of human beings. And when we have a government and people that comprise it who at some point just allow, and this is a message to all sides. I mean, there's nothing I feel more passionately about, that when you allow political ends or money or influence or ego or any other agenda to drive decisions that are going to impact the lives of human beings. You do not belong in the profession of policy and politics. This is a profession that really needs to draw people of goodwill. It used to some extent. It's increasingly not doing that. And by the way, on the issue of the issue of these temperatures, I mean, I know the liberal position is, oh well, that we never, you know, I mean, they clearly stated, this was boldly stated, or I mean, like, they need to be held accountable for this, that we were going to experience substantial warming as a result of us not acting aggressively enough on global warming. The precise symptom that they pointed to that we would be experiencing would be that. And as you can, you know, anybody walking around this country can realize, you know, I think in the last 30, 40 years, I think I'd read, you know, it's like, you know, last year was only the ninth warmest year on record. I mean, okay, well, like, pause. That's like, you have to, like, you can't just dismiss that fact and say it doesn't matter or it's not part of this debate. And I really, and this is where Congress really has to step in my judgment. Congress has to do the job. We know what the administration's agenda is. I don't think any American, I don't even think anyone really of moderate or liberal political persuasion is under the illusion that they're trying to get to the bottom of what's going on with the science. They have a very concrete agenda that's been rooted in political context and contributions to overhaul the way energy is produced and to damage and destroy even other industries such as coal, for instance, and petroleum to some extent, domestically at least. That they have a political problem with, and it's a political problem, not an environmental problem.
Well, like my neighbor across the street wrote in the chat room, and I mean literally across the street, I can throw a stone at his front window. He says, "My conclusion is it's damn cold." Now, what really gets me is they say it's the ninth warmest year since the records have been taken. How long have these records been taken? Not very long
at all.
So they have nothing to compare it against. They don't know if we're right in a cycle or not. Now, I can remember.
No, here's what we do know. We do know that since we've begun recording temperatures, that the last decade and a half, essentially the last 15 years, the temperatures have leveled. They've in essence leveled. And that was, you know, without getting into all of the scientific complexities of it, the scandal behind the so-called hockey stick scandal, where you clearly had demonstrable data that there was a cooling process going on within the environment. So as opposed to just like the scientists who were well aware of that and sought to bury those facts, as opposed to just simply trying to address that as part of open and honest dialogue, even if their conclusion was that it did not impact a perceived trend in global warming, they sought to bury the data. And these are the very people that we're now to turn to and believe as leading the charge, you know, of honest analysis of what's happening in a field that honestly is hugely complex. This is not a layperson's business. All right. I mean, every lay person who's thought about policy probably has an opinion on it. Every lay person who's thought about public policy probably has some degree of knowledge on it. But these are hugely complex issues. And I'm concerned, and I think a lot of Americans who look at it are concerned, that the scientific community that's been most engaged in this to some extent have been somewhat conspiratorial in concealing data that has contradicted the thesis they reached before they even began the research.
Yeah, they're doing a little bass ackwards, as someone likes to say. They take their conclusion and then they make the facts fit it. That's not how science works. You take a conclusion and you say, all right, fine, I want to prove or disprove, and then you go about doing both, trying to prove it correct or trying to disprove it by looking at the facts logically and weighing them equally. But they didn't do that when they did this report, and that. Group in England, and I keep on forgetting the name of the group that put out that initial report, they had a huge scandal with emails that came exposed saying
yes.
That they deliberately omitted facts. They deliberately ignored certain facts. How can you call yourself an honest scientist?
They deliberately conspired to conceal years of data on record that contradicted the theory that the climate was in fact warming. Now, in my judgment, you know, like, to be fair about this, which is really what I want to be fair about, like, I don't think it's appropriate on the other side to stand up and say we've definitively proven that there is no global warming. I mean, you know, like, our conclusions need to be driven by science too. I mean, I think wouldn't every American more or less be a little, you know, concerned? I mean, if it was demonstrable scientific data that this was happening, I think you could have an open dialogue about what, if anything, should be done with it. But we know, as you just pointed out, that we're imposing policies that are killing jobs, that are hurting families, that are raising the cost of energy. And what we don't know is whether we're chasing something real, somewhat real, a little bit real in 500 years, or something, you know, in the minds of some that's completely illusory. And it seems to me that that's where the focus should be. You know, let the science dictate it, and let the science be presented in open. You know, and you know, this is like, if you're a member of Congress, like, this is what you've got to do. I mean, you've got to get, you know, the testimony of scientists. It's got to be presented factually on analytical data. And there's many sides on this issue, and they need to be heard. And policies need to come out of the facts, not the facts out of what are the political conclusions under which they entered the debate. In essence, that's, you know, the abbreviated Cliff Notes version of what I think's gone on in the environmental debate of the last, 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, well, then it comes up to my point where, yes, we can put the facts forward. Then again, when we want to change people's minds, we have to change them through their hearts. So when we put these facts together, we have to make the picture so real that they understand it affects their very lives. When they say, all right, your electric bill right now is, say, $200. When this bill goes through, your electric bill is going to go up to $400. Do you know that what that means? It means also now the groceries, when you go to the grocery store, they're going to be more expensive. So that extra
ice cream, like,
you want,
another,
you're not going to be able to get.
In fairness also, I mean, like, one of the reasons that we would be hugely beneficial for the country to have a broader range of choice available in energy. So, you know, when Al Gore gets on his Gulfstream and flies across the country to give a lecture on why we need to be driving smaller, more gas-efficient cars, someone ought to, like, be pointing out the hypocrisy of that, right?
Yeah, it does. We should. We say, all right, fine. Al Gore just got on his flight, and he just took off, and, you know, he's got X amount of fuel that's costing him, oh, say, $20,000. But now imagine how much fuel can go into your car for that same $20,000 and how far around the globe you can just drive,
right?
And how
right.
many people you can pack in your car compared to how many he has on his plane serving only him.
In essence, I think, is the concern of liberal elitism in this country, and it's something that the American people need to push back on. And that is that, you know, if you're going to push sort of extremist philosophies about how the country should be run and the changes that should be made, you better be trying to employ it in the way you go about your own habits and practices. And I guess, to the credit of some environmentalists, they've done that. I know they are. They're out there. Good for them for doing it. Who are willingly paying more for their energy out of some, I guess, conviction that they are contributing to the wellness of the planet. Good for those guys. But,
do you mean
like
the ones that were over in the Antarctic and got stuck inside the ice when they were trying
exactly.
to disprove,
well,
they were trying
you know,
to
and the media like, so this is the other thing, like, the media coverage of that, very disappointing. All right, I mean, so it was like literally scientists on their way to, you know, demonstrate in their eyes the effects that global warming was having in that region of the world and with the polar ice caps. They leave. They literally get stuck in the very ice that they contend was eroding under global warming. The report, which, okay, I mean, it's, you can be forgiven for sort of laughing at the irony. I mean, that is the irony of the scenario. But, I mean, the the reporting on it was simply that they got stuck. And then all of a sudden, the reasons for, like, what this whole expedition and why they were going there were sort of, like, conveniently missing from all the reporting. You know, when the real big story was exactly what you just said.
Well,
the Chinese sent out, like, an ice-breaking ship in an attempt to try to rescue them, and that, too, got stuck in the ice.
You just can't make this stuff up. You just cannot make this stuff up. Now, a friend of ours in the chat room wrote this.
But it's a sure, but I don't want to diminish, like, I don't want to diminish the seriousness of the topic. You know, like, my mind is, like, I think we should be open about it. Like, clearly, like just to be fair, you know, I mean, if there is a global warming trend in this country and in this world, you know, like, let's see the scientific data, and then let's really analyze the respective policies that are designed to positively impact it, and let's, as you pointed out, have an honest dialogue about what the costs are, because it's in essence a cost-benefit analysis that has to be done, which is more of an economic decision than anything else. But, you know, if you were able to make, you know, a 0.00001% improvement in this global warming trend, and to your examples, someone's electric bill goes from $200 a month to $400 a month, is that a price the American people feel is in the best interest of the country and the earth and the world? I think you're going to see probably a consensus that it isn't worth it.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is I've noticed, because I always look at my electric bill very carefully, and we have so many things that we know is more energy efficient, you know, through insulation, through changing your windows, through setting the temperature. You know, there's a lot of things that we do. And even now the equipment that we use to heat our homes is so much more energy efficient. But the odd thing is I don't see my bill going down. I always see it climbing up. And then I see my energy use going down, but my bill seems to climb up. No one questions this. No one questions it. We just take that bill and we pay it every month and we don't think about it.
You have a number of factors, really, that I think have gone into that. I mean, number one, like, for instance, why is there not more demand out there to, in essence, you know, develop more competition within the provision of energy? I mean, the American people should be able to make greater choices than they have. I mean, you literally have cities of this country that control the delivery of energy, government controlling the delivery of energy. And then an expectation that somehow the process and the costs associated with that are not going to inevitably be politicized. Of course they are. I mean, you really need a broader range of options available, which means there needs to be both a regulatory climate that allows that to happen. There needs to be a development of kind of the science and technology of it that makes it feasible. And then you've got to have, an open discussion about the value of these alternative approaches, because there's a lot of ways to provide energy.
You know, we've got the State of the Union address tonight, and we're going to have our candidate forum, if the candidates can make it, because of the weather that's being projected. If they don't, we're going to be doing a straw poll based upon the videos from our Tea Party convention in Myrtle Beach. So I've broken it down, each one of the questions. And global warming is one of the questions. But we also were trying to project what was going to be in that speech. And I've heard a lot of pundits.
One thing is clear is you have, again, to my earlier point, a unilateral initiative, again, without hearings in Congress about the impact of it, without any reaching out to the other parties, without even any vote in Congress, unilateral initiative of this administration to raise the minimum wage at a time in this country when there is definitive data that shows that, you know, those initiatives are job busting initiatives. You know, I can remember one time I don't recall when it was exactly what the year was, but I was on with one of Al Gore's speechwriters on this issue, and he's making the arguments for increasing the minimum wage. And, you know, it's something that on the surface seems so logical and sensible, and clearly there are so many Americans who continue to struggle in a low-wage economy that is low wage for reasons, in my judgment, that go far beyond what regulations are about how people are paid. But the one
point he made was, I don't recall exactly the amount, he's like, it needs to be raised $1.25 per hour. And I think my rebuttal, which really just occurred to me at that time, and I don't know why we don't talk about it, is, well, why just $1.25 an hour? Look, why wouldn't you raise it $10 an hour or $20 an hour? Why don't we make the minimum wage $100 an hour? That's the minimum wage. Well, everyone knows the answer to that, right? Because, I mean, you ultimately develop a wage structure in this country mandated by government that is oblivious to the realities of P&L, profit and loss, the balance sheets of American businesses, many of which are hovering on the brink of insolvency and, you know, need to be calculating in their wage development. You know, and the good news about the United States of America, and this is still true, if you don't like your wages in your current job, the good news, you can still move down the street and take another job. You know, if you don't like the upside opportunity that's presented in your current job, you still have the flexibility and the ability to pursue alternatives. So my position on that is that the government is not helping any upward trend in wages through these initiatives, and it's very clear, and it's been demonstrated that they've been job killing in their nature. So that's one thing that clearly is going to come out of the State of the Union tonight. But again, as opposed to what, by the way, it's again that's a position that good-willed people can like differ on. It's certain, like, I don't think there's any illusion about what this president represented when he ran for office, and this was probably one of the themes and initiatives that people expected. But the key is we have a Congress of the United States, 535 members that were also elected, and they're going to be completely shut out of this debate and of this decision, and there will be no vote in Congress on it. Why will there be no vote on Congress? Because it wouldn't pass in this Congress, and this administration is basically, which I think is the untold story, is done working with Congress, and not just done working with the Republicans, they're done working with even members of their own party. They're like, let's do everything we can within, you know, a unilateral, non-collaborative initiative in many ways that are very questionable from a constitutional stand, balance of power standpoint, and basically advance our agenda that way, as opposed to what I think is the more proper way, which has been, in essence, I think the approach of every president that I've in my lifetime who has said, you know, there is a realpolitik scenario that exists in Washington, D.C. You can go there with the greatest of ideas, but ultimately, you know, you've got other people who've got their ideas, and you've got to be able to, you know, either make the case for your argument persuasively and win these votes, or you got to be prepared to make reasonable compromise. But this administration really doesn't want to do both. It really isn't particularly persuasive when it comes to explaining why the things it's doing should be done, and then it clearly doesn't really want to have hearings or votes on these issues, because I think it foresees what the outcome was. That, by the way, I mean, it can never be said too often enough. Is there any illusion about why this administration did not want members of Congress to take the 3 or 4 days it would have required to read the Obamacare legislation? Well, I mean, why was it so urgent? And then they're like, literally, now they've been like unilaterally postponing deadlines. Now all of a sudden, there's really no urgency in implementing the actual policy. The reality is, they felt they had things aligned from a political standpoint. They felt that they knew that this was immensely controversial legislation filled with all kinds of ramifications, and you literally had, in essence, an overhaul of the way healthcare is provided in this country without a hearing, and without even an opportunity for one member of Congress to read the legislation on which they were asked to vote yes or no. That's outrageous. It's unacceptable. And I don't care if you're the biggest Obamacare fan in the world, you should agree that's outrageous and unacceptable from a procedural standpoint. And it really is a dangerous precedent for the direction of this country.
All right. You are absolutely correct, because now Boehner had just made a statement just a little while ago telling President Obama not to do the minimum wage using executive order, and he made a veiled threat, not directly referencing, but he said House Republicans will look closely at whether the president is faithfully executing the laws as he took an oath to do. That goes directly to H.R. 442, the stop resolution that our great senator of South Carolina, Tim Rice, put it forward. So he's actually threatening to go forward with 442 in that statement. So they're taking good hard.
And that's my point. Like, I mean, this administration, you know, a lot of Americans support increasing the minimum wage. There's a lot of support for it. A lot of it rests, I think, on a lack of opponents of it to articulate why it's a job-killing initiative and the ramifications of that. But what does this administration really have to fear? I mean, we're about ready to have another off-year congressional election here in 2014. You know, they know they're not going to win on minimum wage legislation. It would seem to me that from a strict political standpoint, you know, let these Republicans go out and vote against it and go home and articulate why they voted against it. The key is they want to advance this agenda in quasi-autocratic, quasi-totalitarian methodologies without having to collaborate with anyone, without having to explain why it's in the best interest of the country, without really having to, have any direct accountability for it, without having any opportunity for anyone to amend, discuss, alter any of these initiatives. And it's really the first time, I think, in the history of this country where that's become essentially the protocol of this administration in the way that it advances its political agenda.
Yeah, well, I wrote on my blog, which I posted a link to it up in the chat room, back on January 14th, because someone wrote in a local newspaper supporting the increase to the minimum wage, and I basically broke it down. I mentioned about 92 million Americans that are either unemployed or underemployed, and they want my friend over here in the chat room also mentioned it. They want to make illegal immigration amnesty. You still have 92 million Americans out of work. The minimum wage increase is going to put people out of work because the majority of jobs are coming from small businesses. A large business can afford to raise the cost of their products, but a small business can't because they've got to compete against a large business, and they're going to have to cut jobs.
And, Annie, I have not heard yesterday or today as news surfaced that this is going to be announced tonight in the State of the Union, any discussion of the fact that if there's one issue that really should fall within 10th Amendment grounds of being a state issue, not a federal issue, minimum wage is it. You know, I mean, $10 plus dollars in, you know, rural Mississippi is a one wage. $10 plus dollars if you're working in Manhattan is a complete other one. And really states are the political institutions and the appropriate places for these issues to be debated. And I think it clearly, again, it just, you know, I mean, if you read the 10th Amendment and you actually ask yourself, which is a reason I'm a very big supporter of something called the Enumerated Powers Act, which, you know, in essence would require members of Congress with any piece of legislation to explain why this is constitutional, why it doesn't, for instance, fall under a 10th Amendment grounds of an issue that should be more properly addressed at a state level. We need to have some degree of consideration before we push through federal legislation. These things shouldn't always just routinely be ending up in the courts, which I think is kind of like the position of the progressive elite in this country, which is to say, you know, we'll just ram this through. We kind of think, yeah, it might be unconstitutional, and let the courts figure it out. No, that, you know, admittedly, the courts are there exactly for that reason, to define the parameters of constitutionality of legislation. But it doesn't absolve a member of Congress administration from also being mindful of it. And as everyone knows, that is the key oath that you make when you assume the presidency of the United States. And yet how much time, if any, does this administration spend talking about how to adhere to the Constitution, and how much time do they spend internally in closed West Wing meetings talking about how to circumvent it?
I would say zero time to make anything constitutional and 101% time trying to circumvent. Make that 150%. You know, it was Dan Pfeiffer in one of the shows on Sunday, and I think it might have been Meet the Press, I'm not sure, but he made a mention that he was going to address the minimum wage as well as what he called economic inequality. In other words, spread the wealth again, guys. It's going to be out there. Yeah, there are a couple of pundits that, you know, predicted some of the things that he was going to be mentioning in the thing. He was also going to talk about economic mobility.
Right.
As you said, if we brought everything down to a state issue, we could have economic mobility, because then I can turn around and say, right, fine, I don't want to earn $5 an hour. I want to earn $10 an hour. Let me look where I can get my most dollars, and that dollar will stretch the longest, which is one of the reasons why I came to South Carolina. Even though I'm retired, I said, I want to see where my dollar goes. You know, I'm paying in New York for oil. I'm paying for electricity. I'm paying for insurance. I'm paying for this and that. When it came down to my dollars and cents, and then I compared to what I would be paying for the very same things down in South Carolina, I'm saying, heck, I'm going to have $500 or more in my pocket per month. And you multiply that by 12 months, that's $6,000. I'd rather have $6,000 more at the end of the year in South Carolina than I've been paying more in New York.
You know, and it's a very constructive thing because, you know, like let's just take – let me just give you an example of two big states and two really important states in this country. You know, California, which has a 10% state income tax, and Texas, which has a 0% state income tax. Well, you know, not surprisingly, if you look at the trends of the last 2 years – do you think major companies have been moving from Texas to California, or do you think they've been moving from California to Texas? I mean, not surprisingly, Texas has become the new kind of Western frontier of economic growth in this country. I mean, it's like one of the aberrations, one of the exceptions, you know, where, you know, you've had a pretty good governor and a very good economic climate that has fostered and encouraged and tried to be hospitable to business. By doing that, not surprisingly, business has come there. What's the human ramification of that? The human ramification of it is that there's a demonstrably lower level of unemployment in Texas than there is in California. And yet, you know, if someone for ideology or other reasons thinks, you know, that they should be paying more to government for whatever reason, you know, you still have the right to stay in California, including a company if they feel, you know, that. But it's important, is, you know, like as you experienced on a personal level, that every American on an individual level and every company on an organizational level have the ability to kind of find places in the country that are most hospitable to what they're after and what they seek. It also creates a spirit of, I think, healthy competitiveness that probably, at the end of the day, helps the policy debate in this country, meaning now all of a sudden when there's a tangible ramification, meaning people can cross the border to another state and have a more hospitable environment, you know, that you can't be oblivious to that fact when you're debating and voting on these issues. So not surprisingly, when you look at, like, where's the worst legislation, you know, emerging from? It's emerging from Congress. And you know, and the regulations we discussed from this administration, you know, on a state basis, you continue to have a very, you know, for the most part, a healthy degree of respect for free enterprise, free markets, and the important role that they play in providing economic growth, prosperity, and well-being for the people of the country.
Now, that is so true. You know, you think about it, I believe it's Wyoming that right now has more per capita people earning six figures, you know, over $100,000 than any other state, simply because they opened it up with the oil industry and everything. They've got people flooding there. And they said that more people are earning six figures than any other area. You've also got Nebraska, you know, exploding with employment because they too are using their oil industry. They're telling the federal government, we don't care what you say. We're going to do this in our state, and we're not going to ask any help from you at all, which is what I think each and every state should do. My own state of South Carolina is trying to do that. But then again, you know, we're getting the federal government sticking their nose in where it doesn't belong.
Just circle back on this minimum wage issue, okay? Like, you could just a microcosm, because you could rattle, like, you know, literally hundreds of these debates off. So if you have a 10th Amendment that, you know, to my recollection, states the powers that aren't delegated by the Constitution to the federal government are reserved to the states, or to the people, as the Constitution says. If that's what the 10th Amendment is, can we not have some dialogue tonight about where in the Constitution it says that the wages that private sector employers provide across this country is something that the federal government of the United States is charged with determining? I mean, that to me strikes me as a huge leap of legal judgment that is almost certainly challengeable even in these liberal courts. And yet tonight there will be no discussion of that. There will be discussion of the policy. It will be oversimplified. It will draw to the emotions of the American people on a surface level, and there will be no real consideration of what it means from the standpoint of the erosion of accountability, the erosion of constitutional liberty, and ultimately, in my view, the negative economic impact that policy is going to have on the people of this country.
Well, that's a mouthful, because there was in Modern Farmer, there was a article on there, how a robot can sort 2 tons of grapes in 12 minutes. They go forward with the minimum wage. You're not even going to have these migrant workers in the fields anymore. It'll be all robotics. Anything that can be done robotically, that'll be done. Human jobs will not exist.
Well, you know, and that's another issue. Like, these are huge, like, leaps that the country's going through right now. I think for conservatives, for the party, I guess, that best represents conservative thinking, the Republican Party, and for anyone concerned about liberty, that the mindful impact of the erosion of these industries and the fact that manufacturing, core functional areas that this country was once the leader in, and in some respects is still the leader in, you know, maintaining our engagement in that. I mean, there was really, like, that's one another thing. I mean, there was really never any vote on that. Any real debate on the ramifications of the policies we were enacting. No ramifications of the effect that, unrealistic unions or unfair trade practices or foreign subsidies, all of these things. All of a sudden, America's woken up 2014, and there are core industry sectors that are just gone. And, you know, maybe they come back, maybe they don't. It's unlikely that they come back. And I think that's mindful. And I think from a political perspective, conservatives and Republicans need to become the movement and the party of the working people of this country. And I think they can do that. Because I think – and if we can't do that, we better look at our positions and our policies and ask why it is that a working American would not embrace it. Because we are about job growth. We are about economic prosperity. We are about freedom. We're about, to some extent, keeping America a strong force in the world. We're about maintaining some degree of American identity. Those are all issues that I think sell to working America. And that's the party I want to be affiliated with. That's the movement I want to be affiliated with. And if you ask me when I look out at what anything going on politically that interests me a lot right now, that's the appeal to me of the Tea Party movement, is that I think it appears to me, having spoken at literally dozens of these things, having been on the first organizing calls of the movement, and having done really everything that I can to lend my political, policy, organizational management skill to this movement, I think that is a movement that best represents the interests of working Americans. And, you know, we have to get out there, and that the image of it has to be defended, it has to be articulated, it has to be explained, and the policies that we embrace better be aligned with the best interests of the people of this country, or we will lose, as we have been losing.
That's exactly what I'm saying. You know, you have to make that message coming from the heart, not just the head. You have to marry the two so at least they can feel and understand how it's going to impact their lives, but they can also understand why it's happening so that we can then reverse the course. A lot of times when I go stand before my own county council, and you can hear the groans coming from the people behind the bench when right. I come in on there. And when I do my arguments, and recently they just did a millage rate increase, And I broke it down. I says, you know, you've got someone that is barely rubbing two pennies together going into a store to buy bread and all of a sudden finding the price of bread almost doubled because you decided to increase the millage rate. Here in the state of South Carolina, especially in my county, when a business has any sort of an asset, whether or not it's a desk, a chair, a computer, even the computer program, they tax it at 100% value. So every single year, that business has to put down all of their assets, everything they own. So a grocery store, the cashiers, the display cases, the freezers, every single thing, you know, the hand cart that they move the stuff around in, the grocery carts, every year they have to pay a tax on that to the point where you pay more in taxes than the item is worth. And I said, yeah,
well,
you're hurting the everyday person.
On a real big picture level, like really, you know, like the ultimate message is, I wish we hadn't had the damage to the country that we have had by the 5 years of this administration. It's, you know, in some respects, as I cited earlier, the damage that's been done may not even be reversible. But I am hopeful on one respect, and that is that progressivism is no longer some hypothetical intellectual discussion. The American people have now seen the practical ramifications of it. On every measurable metric that you would use, that you would look at or that would matter, this administration's policies have failed. Every promise that they made to the American people about what the impact of their policies would be have failed. They did not create the millions of jobs that they said their policies would create. They destroyed millions of jobs. They have not increased access to quality health care. They have diminished access to quality health care. They have not increased the earnings or the well-being of the American family. They have hurt the American family. And they have not, importantly, in a world where just the other day the State Department is warning U.S. Olympians not to wear any U.S. Attire as they walk the streets at the Russian Olympics, restored the image of the United States in the world. The image of the United States in the world has never been this bad, nor has this country been so weak, nor have we been so at risk of losing our stature as a global leader. So, you know, every promise, every concept that was introduced under this banner phrase of hope and change was a lie that has been hugely damaging the American people. And so now the key is, can the other side sort of look at the reality of the situation, realize that we cannot be perceived or in practice be pawns of anything but the interests of the American people, and wed ourselves to that, and wed ourselves to the Constitution, and wed ourselves to individual liberty, and explain to the American people what the practical ramifications of us doing this will be, and take the country back, as to use the often used Tea Party phrase. I believe that's the absolute challenge that's in front of us. And by the way, you know, I spent a lot of time the first 2 years as a national leader in the Tea Party movement trying to fend off an allegation that somehow I was a pawn of big business. I hope that the people that made those allegations have taken a little bit of time to read the $50 million that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has just put into trying to defeat the Tea Party movement in this country. $50 million that they put in because they want to grant amnesty to illegals who came illegally, who are going to work at cheap rates and take jobs from Americans, and because they view our policy agendas as somehow threatening to an elitist agenda in this country. My judgment is we clearly from the very beginning were aligned with the best interests of this country. We were never pawns of anybody but our founding fathers' vision for the future of this country. We certainly were not pawns of big business, nor were we enemies of big business like this administration might be. But, you know, like, where are the apologies? You know, my phone has not rang with apologies of the progressives and liberals who pointedly made those allegations behind my back, you know, in articles, in interviews, on MSNBC, or in debates with me. It's just like we just kind of move on. Like, they throw these malicious allegations out there, and the media just kind of move on. No one circles back and say, hey, by the way, you remember back in 2009 when you sort of said Michael Johns and this whole movement were pawns of big business, can you sort of explain why big business is putting $50 million into trying to defeat them?
You know, you just hit exactly every single point I hit because I saw an article, someone put it up, I believe, on Facebook, that Lindsey Graham proclaimed himself a Chamber of Commerce Republican. And I went WTF, and I went and railed against that. Oh, yeah, the Lindsey Graham is the Chamber of Commerce that supported unions, then supported illegal immigration. I probably wrote about a 10-paragraph item just blasting back and going after all this stupid – I mean, don't get me started on my favorite subject, Lindsey Graham. I mean,
right.
I just railed against someone else.
Well, you know,
there's
a reason why there's – like, for instance, there's a reason why there's, like, 10 other business organizations in this country. They emerged predominantly because, in many respects, the Chamber of Commerce were not representing the interests of economic growth and economic liberty.
They don't care about small business.
Particularly small business. It's long been known that, you know – and by the way – we need to be champions of small business. I mean, and like our communities are being changed. The face of our communities are being changed. The country we live in is being changed. And
I think we lost Michael.
Feels it. And this is my
– He just went silent.
There?
But
no,
Michael is absolutely correct. I mean, when I started my small business, we were a member of the Chamber of Commerce. But now I want nothing to do with the Chamber of Commerce. We were members for years. They didn't do squat for the small business. They did everything for large companies in the area. And they called me up. Well, why don't you take your membership out?
Are you there?
I'm here.
Mike, we can hear you.
Okay. Yeah. I'll avoid my NSA jokes.
Yeah. Well, the Chamber of Commerce is nothing more than another branch of the Republican Party in the Rhino sense. That's all it is. Number one is their whole goal is more regulations and more taxes because the billionaires can afford all that. It's the small business like us that they want to crush, and that's what they're totally squeezing.
By the way, to state the obvious, what both of you know clearly, that's where job creation lies and rests. It's small businesses in this country, not big businesses, that are the core of whether we do or do not grow economically, and you can't simultaneously suffocate the interests of small business and expect that you're going to have anything except what we've had, which is a growing rank of unemployed and underemployed Americans, diminished wages, and lost hope. And I think that that's true. So, and by the way, here's my dream. Right? This is my like if someone said, "What is your political dream?" I wish. There's been a lot of cliches said about this, about, you know, how we need to like not think as Republicans, not think as Democrats, which I completely agree with. I think there's a feeling out in the country right now that we're losing this country. I mean, I don't think that it's an overstatement. I mean, I hear it. I see it because I talk to people on a very high level. I talk to many members of Congress. I talk to many working Americans. I mean, I just know a lot of people by nature of my profession and by nature of the work that I've done. And I hear it said to me individually, and you can hear the individual stories of the pain and suffering that they've gone through. You can hear the fear that they have about the future. And you can hear the fact that they're under no illusions that the country that they loved is eroding. It's being lost. My feeling is like, and this is like a message to like Democrats, you know, I mean, maybe even left-leaning Democrats, is like, can we go back to the concept of just preserving individual liberty of the country? Because really, more than anything, more than arguing about whether we should have troops in Afghanistan, more than arguing about what our marginal tax rate should be, more than you know arguing about whether we should or shouldn't have this or that social policy, and I have strong views on all of those issues. My perception right now is all of that stuff is almost irrelevant if we cannot salvage a country where constitutional order is preserved. And like, and I cannot imagine any other administration that would be engaged in literally systematic, unwarranted espionage, spying, and monitoring of the American people, of innocent Americans, where the entire country wouldn't just grind to a halt, where that would be the whole focus of Congress. You wouldn't stop until you got to the bottom of this thing. And yet, am I wrong, you know, as someone who's followed this acutely for my whole adult life and been involved at the highest levels as a White House speechwriter in D.C., et cetera, in saying that I don't see anything grinding to a halt? I see a country that's just sort of forging ahead, oblivious to the realities that are unfolding right in front of our eyes. These are not theories as they once were, that we have a government that's recklessly out of control and that is infringing on the rights of the American people. These are facts. These are demonstrable facts. Where is the action? Where is the outrage? And my perception is, like, I know the Tea Party movement's on board with this. I believe it's bigger than that. The American people are on board with this. Where is the outrage? And where's the plan to stop it? Because you don't get these things back. I started my career in foreign policy, and I particularly focused my foreign affairs expertise in countries that were totalitarian in nature, particularly those that were supported by the Soviet Union, trying to help support the Reagan vision of liberating those. And the ones that you would hear over and over and over and over again that when you went into those countries was, we wish we had done more to have stopped what was imposed upon us. Now, in some cases like Afghanistan, you know, you weren't going to stop the you know, Soviet tanks from rolling through the streets of Kabul. That was probably unrealistic. But, you know, many of these countries have sort of just kind of flirted with these autocratic non-abandonments of liberty, have ended up losing it and then not getting it back. This is not just sort of something that it's, you know, like a balloon that just kind of floats up and you pull down and pull up. I mean, once it's gone, it's gone. And then
I have a question for you, Mike. Was George W. Bush just completely stupid to not think that when he started all this, it would lead to where we are now with a tyrant? I mean, I just don't get it.
It's like even the pointing of the finger at particular individuals is like a distraction from the broader fact. Okay, so can we concede that liberty, individual liberty, was eroded under the Bush 43 presidency? Yes, I say as a White House speechwriter to Bush 41 and as someone who voted for President Bush 43 twice, that it clearly was eroded under his leadership. And what reasons did it happen? I mean, I can only give you my thesis. My thesis was a perception that the Al-Qaeda threat globally and to this country was so immense that it represented a threat to the stability of this country. And arguments were made and apparently accepted that compromises could be made, compromises that were understood in the Patriot Act, compromises that were done covertly and were never even announced to the American people, that suffocated individual liberty. And now you have an administration, unlike George W. Bush, who's even more ideologically inclined to erode those liberties, sees that almost as their endgame. A country that right now, like literally at this moment, has to be like burning with a sense of urgency about this. You know, this is no longer another routine political debate. This is no longer like the things that we faced before. This is no longer a question of, you know, should we have Bob Dole or Bill Clinton in the White House? I mean, those were like different visions of the country, but ultimately the country's government was still accountable to the people, whichever way you voted. We're now dealing with an administration, and it'll emerge tonight again in the State of Union, that is acting through edict, almost indistinguishable from tyrannies around the world, completely oblivious to the constitutions, the 10th Amendment particularly that I referenced before, and the fact that at the very least, if these aren't state issues, they need to be going through an appropriate due process at a congressional level, including open hearings and testimony and analytics, and then ultimately an open vote where people press yes or no on their vote and are held accountable for the ramifications of that vote. We are, for the most part, policies that are being rolled out in 21st century America are not going through that traditional deliberative process where you have A, open discussion of the merits or demerits of particular policy initiatives, B, a process where you're allowed to petition your government with what your position is on those issues, and then three, some degree of political accountability for the people that enacted those policies if they turn out wrongly. You know, I mean, you can't. You can turn around and like, what member of Congress are you going to turn around and vote out? You know, when this minimum wage legislation destroys another 2 million jobs. You know, there's not even a member of these members of Congress, even if they supported it conceptually, are going to say, "I never voted for it. I was never given a chance to vote for it." You know, we're providing them with a lack of accountability that ultimately is at the core of eroding the foundation of the country. And it's been said, and I just only see like this. So the Tea Party movement, for what it is articulating that. The Tea Party movement is imperfect, by the way. I mean, let's just sort of start talking about that open and honestly. This movement needs to be a lot bigger. It's got to be a lot more inclusive. It's got to be more persuasive. It's got to be led by people that are articulate and have experience and can do these things. And then ultimately, it has to appeal beyond our base. And if we can't do those fundamental things, I have a very pessimistic perception about the direction of this country in the coming years.
Well, the problem I think with our Tea Party, and I think we're all pretty much members of the Tea Party, is that the Tea Party is too close to the Republicans, which are way too close to where we're not. And the Tea Party has all of a sudden decided, well, the Democrats or the Republicans are the lesser of the evils. No, it's an independent party that stands for liberty, that believes in entrepreneurship. I'll give you another perfect example.
Hang on a second, Mike. There's something that's really strange that's been happening, and because I was up at the Tea Party convention this past weekend over at Myrtle Beach, and I've seen this happening county by county, and even my own GOP here, they're starting to turn more conservative. We are getting our conservative people inside the Republican Party, and we're starting to take it back.
Position.
And here we've got 46 counties in South Carolina. As of last week, 7 out of these 46 have censured Lindsey Graham, and more are starting to put resolutions before their groups.
And you had the entire Arizona GOP just censor John McCain, incredibly. Unanimously, not
so
one dissenting vote.
We have to infiltrate them and take them back.
And Annie, so you guys
reality
just voted,
is, and
South Carolina just voted, what was it, 101-0 against drones from the feds flying in their state immediately. And this is something that I am noticing, is that Michigan is doing the same thing. I'm in Michigan, by the way, Mike, and he's in South Carolina. But Michigan, I can't think of the guy's name, but it's in legislation now. It was drafted, and he's writing it up to do the same thing and to prevent the drones. And I don't think that the Tea Party is going to be successful in the GOP. The GOP
is already
controlled by its billionaires.
Okay, so here's my perception on that, okay? And we need to be mindful that the Tea Party itself is not controlled by billionaires, all right? So my viewpoint is, I mean, we're accountable only to principles, and hopefully to principles that we're able to sell politically, because otherwise they're just concepts. But if you want to make that work, if ultimately you want to make that successful, it does seem to me to make perfect sense to say, look, there's two major political parties in this country. If you have concern with the Republican Party and its leadership, then, you know, what the Tea Party is doing makes perfect sense. I mean, I don't understand what the uproar is, really. I don't understand the Karl Rove position. I mean, it just seems to me to be rooted in, well, you know, if we have more people with R's behind our name. Well, you know, I mean, we've had bad policies put forward by Republicans as well. And many of these policies have been in depth. I mean, if someone's not going to go there and defend the Constitution of the United States to their death, you don't want them as a member of Congress. So I love the fact that we've been able, in state after state, to put our focus in identifying, selecting, and nominating candidates that are more representative of our ideas and values. That, to me, is part of taking back this party. and a very important initiative. Now, if the conclusion ultimately is that that can't be done for reason A, B, or C, then I guess you can hypothetically go on to a plan B. The history of third parties in this country is not one that's proven very successful. It's not a country, I think, because of its size especially, that lends itself particularly well to a to the success of a third political party. And I'm impressed on a local and regional level. Many of these initiatives I've been intimately involved with and have supported, conceived of even, how we have been able to, with just a certain degree of effort, to take over Republican Party leaderships at the most local of levels and at state levels, and to take over city commissions and school boards. And those are all important, hugely important things. I mean, so it's like, if you've made a step to take over your local GOP and you failed, like, my judgment is we almost have to take a step back and say, well, hold on, like, why did that fail? What is it about? I mean, how were we not possible to do this? Because, the Republican Party is a big party, and I've worked for a number of Republicans who would not be described as conservative Republicans, and I've seen the way that they think. And I endured some of the criticism of people who, about those affiliations. My response always was, like take Olympia Snowe in Maine. Like, if you had a problem with Olympia Snowe, you got to go up and change the mindset of the people of Maine, because the people of Maine are the ones who put her in there. And she was at one point the most popular U.S. senator in the entire U.S. Senate among her state constituencies. So we need to do a much better job of articulating our vision to the American people, explaining why it is, an appropriate one, explaining how it's going to work, and winning the hearts and minds of the American people. You can't do that. You're not really helping us, in my judgment. And my view is, I think there were, it varies state by state, and I can understand the frustration that some conservative have had in the positions of the Republican Party in their state. But by and large, you got to kind of look at it and say, with the exception of the national level, which even just appointed a Tea Party liaison, which I thought was a nice step for them to take, the Tea Party movement's had a lot of success in winning some of these battles of definition as to what the GOP is. And I think if you read the platform of the GOP, to the extent, I'm not trying to say that that's the most critically relevant thing in the world. Obviously, the voting records are more important. But the GOP platform continues to be a hugely conservative document. I mean, like, you really wouldn't find within it many positions. I don't believe that the Tea Party wouldn't embrace uniformly and universally.
Right,
so it
Mike,
remains.
Mike, we're down to our last two and a half minutes. I mean, this has gone so fast. I can't even believe it. I'm looking at the clock going, oh my goodness, it's 3:30 already. I hate to say this.
Before we let Mike go, who do you like in the Super Bowl?
This is going to be a good one. And I'm going to tell you that I believe that you got in Denver a really effective quarterback and an incredible offense against, probably the best offense in football, against in Seattle, probably the best defense in football. Whoever prevails in that part of this is gonna win. So if the Denver offense can win against the Seattle defense, I think then Denver wins. If the Seattle defense is effective, I think Seattle wins. I don't mean to be dodging your question, but that in essence will be a big part of it.
Well, thank you, Mike. We appreciate your joining us. God bless America and you and your family.
Pleasure. Thank you very much. Nice speaking with both of you.
Oh, wow. What a fantastic, fantastic guest. And we're definitely going to have to get him to come back on. We're down to our last minute
and a
half.
I think he was probably the best speaker we've had. We've had really good speakers, but I think one thing I like that Michael Johns did, he spoke layperson's terms. There wasn't a lot of – you didn't need a lot of clarification because he spoke – and he's accurate, Anyway.
Well, let me let people know that on Friday when they come back, Jason Matera will be with us. And following Tuesday, we're bringing Trevor Loudon back, who has actually made a splash nationwide with his presidential team pick, starting with Ted Cruz and all the way on down. But we'll save that for next Tuesday. So I hope everyone joins us back again here on Friday, same bat time, same bat station, and we'll pick up where we left off. Until then, Good night. God bless. And be careful with that weather outside.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble.
You've been listening to Southern Sense Blog Talk Radio. Producer and your hostess extraordinaire is Ann Ubelis. The theme music, American Stand Up, is written and performed by Don Fortney. For more from Don, check out his webpage, teapartymusic.web.com. Southern Sense, the proud member of Ghost Fighter Radio and Freedom Media Network. Southern Sense is common sense. Take it out, Don.
American.